It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We food writers love to be long-winded, but the length that some of us go to explain how to get crisp skin on a roast chicken is absurd. I mean, this is simple. The chicken has to be dry, so you pat it dry. It needs some oil and salt and pepper on the skin, so you rub it with olive oil and salt and pepper. You need high heat, so you set your oven at 450. The chicken needs to be elevated, so you put it on a rack over a pan with a little water in it. Roast it for 10 to 15 minutes to the pound, give it a 10-minute rest, and then go for the crunch. Well, stay with us. There's more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. As a cookbook author, I shouldn't tell you this, but I'm going to anyway. You don't need half my recipes or anybody else's. One recipe gives you one dish, one technique, and you can eat for days. Well, starting with this idea, Michael Ruhlman thought out his new basics cookbook, Ruhlman's 20. 20 techniques, 100 recipes, a cook's manifesto. So, Michael, good to see you.
Good to be here, Lynn. Thank you.
So, Michael, this book isn't arranged the way most cookbooks are, from appetizers to desserts. It's arranged by techniques, right?
Yes. Techniques, how to use the tools at hand in the kitchen, and basic techniques of applying heat and also taking heat away.
Okay, so I'm going to pick a few things here. So first of all, one chapter is water.
We don't think about water, but it's really a remarkable substance. And if we recognize it for the powerhouse tool in the kitchen that it is, then we become a better cook. It's a flavor extractor. It's a heat extractor. It's a heat conveyor. It's its own thermometer. It won't go above 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So when you cook something in water, you cook it very, very gently.
Now, you also do something in that chapter that I don't think people do very much at all, and that is you put food in a container and you put that container in a water bath.
Yeah, it's a very valuable tool. When we make a meatloaf, for instance, you need a certain amount of fat in a meatloaf for it to be juicy, of course. But if you cook it too hard, that fat can cook out and break out of the mixture, and then you're left with a dry, rubbery meatloaf. But if you put it into a tureen mold or some kind of baking pan, a loaf pan or whatever, and put that pan in this gentle water in a moderate oven, you will slowly cook that meat till it's done, and all the fat and flavor will stay in the meat, and you'll have an incredibly juicy, tender, wonderful meatloaf using the gentle heat of water.
Let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Butter. Cooking with butter.
Yes, one of our favorite ingredients. Something never to be out of in your household. Butter is something. It's more than just something to spread on your toast. It's its own tool. It's a sort of a ready-made sauce. It's a mixture of fat and water, just like most sauces. It's also something that people don't think about often. It is a cooking medium. You can cook things in butter, and it too, like water, will cook them very gently. But the density of the fat, I believe, keeps the flavor and juices in the meat and in the fish. In the book, we butter poach shrimp for very succulent, very juicy, very delicate shrimp. You don't want to cook shrimp really hard because it will become rubbery and dry. But when you cook it gently in the very dense environment of some butter that's kept emulsified but still liquid and warm, you have these beautiful, luxurious, succulent, delicious, buttery shrimp. It's fabulous.
How exactly do you do that butter poaching? Can you walk us through that?
Yes, absolutely. What you need to do is melt the butter while maintaining the emulsification. Again, butter is fat, some butter solids, and about 15% water. And if you start melting the butter in chunks in a little bit of water and whisking continuously, you can melt this butter and keep it emulsified so that it's a homogeneous. You know, if you melt butter, just melt it for popcorn or something, the fat rises to the top and you've got the water separates out.
Right, right.
You get clear butter. Well, this way, if you keep it emulsified, you've got this opaque, thick, wonderful, creamy cooking device. It's a great basting tool. It's a great to add to sauces. In professional kitchens, it's often referred to as Bermonté because they use it to enrich sauces with. But it's also a great cooking vehicle at home.
And so you whisk the butter with a little bit of water, and then you slip in the shrimp?
Yes, you get all your butter melted, so you've got a few inches in your pan. Choose the right size pan so you don't need too much butter. And then pop your shrimp in and keep it warm. The butter will stay at about 150 degrees, and that's a perfect temperature to cook shrimp at. Again, the shrimp cooked this way will not seize up on you. It will be very tender, delicious shrimp when cooked this gently.
Oh, this sounds wonderful. I guess you could cook almost anything that way. You could do a chicken breast.
Ooh, yeah, that would be a way to sort of redeem the skinless, boneless chicken breast is to cook it in butter.
Lovely. Michael, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Lynn.
Michael Ruhlman's book is Ruhlman's 20, 20 Techniques, 100 Recipes, A Cook's Manifesto. Now, that butter poaching technique gives seafood the silkiest texture you could imagine. So try Michael's butter poached shrimp with grits. The recipe is on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our podcasts and online store, all stocked for the holiday, splendidtable.org. Kid ourselves. Politics plays a large role in what's on our dinner plates. Professor Marion Nestle knows this from firsthand experience. She's worked in government. She's an authority on food politics. Marion also was a force behind one of the broadest academic food programs in the United States. It's at New York University, where she's a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health. Well, with all of this, Marion decided to teach the 2012 Farm Bill. Well, Marion joins us from NYU. Marion, it's good to have you back with us.
Oh, glad to be here.
You decided to teach the Farm Bill. Why?
Well, I didn't know anything about it. And I knew that I would be asked by reporters, because I'm asked by reporters about everything, and they think I know everything. And in 2006, when the previous Farm Bill was under discussion, I actually tried to read it. And I opened up the file that was on the internet, and the table of contents was 14 pages long. And the entire thing was 663 pages, and it's totally incomprehensible. So I decided to take it on, and I must say I've had moments when I've regretted it deeply. But it's been absolutely fascinating, and the class is enormously exciting. I've got 45 students who are jumping out of their seats because what they're finding out is so absolutely amazing, and none of us knew any of this before. So we're kind of we're learning it together.
What's making them jump out of their seats?
Well, it's so astonishingly irrational, it just takes your breath away. This is a bill that started in the 1930s and has been added on to incrementally without anybody sitting back and saying, if we want to promote farm policy, a rational farm policy in the United States, and a rational farm policy, we all agree, would feed everybody, would make a living for farmers, would protect farm workers, would protect the environment, and would promote health. That's totally rational, right?
Right, yeah.
And the bill does anything but that. It is designed to protect certain parts of the food supply but not others, commodities, not fruits and vegetables. You know, in today's concern about obesity, the idea that the Farm Bill does not promote production and consumption of fruits and vegetables seems bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things about the bill that are so completely irrational, they just take your breath away. For example, if a commodity producer decides to grow vegetables, that producer will either lose all the subsidies that he's getting or will have to plow the vegetables under. They are required by the way this law works to plow them under, treat them with Roundup and kill them, or let them freeze. But they're not allowed to actually grow and sell them. So there are real discouraging things in it that actually discourage production of fruits and vegetables. And you would think that somebody in Congress would sit back and say, okay, let's take a look at this and let's try to get agricultural policy aligned with health policy. But that is so far from the political reality that what this course is really about is the political realities and what you have to do if you want to change those realities.
So is there any way for the consumer to get any kind of say on any of this?
Well, one of the things that's most disturbing to me about the bill is that it is so absolutely incomprehensible that nobody can understand it. It is so vast and includes the most astonishing details about the most astonishing number of programs, dozens and dozens and dozens. I've not yet been able to identify them all. Each title of the Farm Bill, each section of it, covers different kinds of programs, and these range from tiny programs that affect only a few people, earmarks that were put in there at some time or other, to things like food stamps, the SNAP program, that affects, you know, 45 to 50 million people, or however many there are, the numbers keep going up every month. And what the food assistance programs are doing in the Farm Bill is another thing. Neither one of them can be looked at rationally because they're completely linked. And the reason that they're linked is because the senators and House members who have interests in one or another aspect say, I'll vote for yours if you vote for mine. And so the food assistance programs are held hostage to farm subsidies, and the farm subsidies are held hostage to food assistance programs. And you cannot read the Farm Bill because each aspect of it refers to amendments to previous bills. So unless you know the 30 different previous bills that have been passed, you really can't. It doesn't read like a text. And one more point. Nobody in Congress can understand it either.
That's scary.
That's scary.
Marion, thank you.
My pleasure.
Marion Nessel is professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. She's also the author of Food Politics. For more information, go to our website, splendidtable.org. Well, we're going to be back with one of the UK's favorite cooks, Diana Henry. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Diana Henry is a food journalist based in London. She writes for the Sunday Telegraph, among others. But in my mind's eye, I always see Diana heading to an airport. She's all over the planet. I mean, you can see just how her cooking echoes her travels when you flip through her books. Well, her latest is Salt, Sugar, Smoke. She's joining us from London. Diana, it's really good to have you back.
Good to be back with you too, Lynn.
But I want to compare notes. What's happening in the UK? What are people eating now?
Well, there has been a big move, which was kind of bubbling under for quite a while, and now it's sort of coming out big time, and that's vegetables. I don't mean people are turning vegetarian, but they are cooking less meat and fish maybe three times a week, and where you might find a little bit of meat maybe in a salad to start a meal, the main course could actually be vegetarian. And I've noticed it in restaurants and also in the things that my friends have been cooking me, the dinner parties I've gone to over the summer, vegetables are in.
So why do you think this is happening? I mean, do you think it's the economy? Is it health?
I think it's got a little bit to do with the recession. I think that people are having to pay a bit more attention. Because the other thing I've noticed is that I'm not eating so much Mediterranean stuff. When I'm going to people's houses, I'm finding, you know, carrot soup with ginger, and then it'll be served with harissa and yogurt. But it's carrots. It's not kind of like roasted peppers. So I'm seeing them use a lot of our own vegetables from here, northern vegetables, even though they might be giving them a Mediterranean or a North African kind of, you know, spin.
Yeah, it's interesting. So what kinds of things are you cooking these days?
Well, this is my favorite time of year to cook because the pumpkin and the squash come in. So I've got friends coming this weekend, and I was just working it out in the cab actually on the way here whether I would do, I love a roast squash lasagna. I make squash lasagna, and sometimes I put fennel in it as well, and sometimes I put wild mushrooms in it. But that, nobody doesn't love lasagna, Lynn. I don't know if you find that. It takes me half a day to make, but when you put it on the table, there's a sigh of contentment.
Yeah, yeah.
And before that, because I don't like mixing up cultures too much, I'll probably have a bagna cauda, which is a Piedmontese dip. Well, you'll know about this, with your anchovies and your garlic and a little butter and olive oil, all kind of heated until the anchovies melt. And then I'll put a platter out of winter or autumn vegetables with that. So there'll be carrots and chicory and that kind of thing. The thing that's important, I think, about this kind of cooking is some of it is so simple. You do have to have good stuff. I mean, when I say bagna cauda with crudités, I do not mean those dreadful things that you get in packs in the supermarket when it comes to the crudités. You have to prepare those just before you're going to eat them, and they have to look beautiful, and you have to have chosen good things in the first place. Or I could go a little bit kind of North African spicy, but with a little Eastern in as well, and do roast squash with little vine tomatoes still on the vine. And I'll roast those with star anise and chili and ginger and olive oil. And then I'll take them out. And before they're ready, I will actually add a tin of chickpeas that I've actually sautéed just to warm a bit. Put it back in the oven. When that comes out, about 15 minutes later, then I scatter the whole thing with coriander. Because that's the other thing about vegetables. You can add little special things that, in fact, don't take much time but make all the difference. I'm very fond of sautéing onions until they're really quite dark, almost kind of like tobacco-y.
Uh-huh.
And putting a little sugar in them, a little chili and a little mint and a good squeeze of lime or lemon. And then I toss that all over the dish just before I serve it. And that, honestly, you hear how easy that is. That's the kind of thing I will cook. And people say, how did you do that? It's like, how did I do it? I put it in the oven. I mean, it's really not hard. And on the side for that, I might do lovely, I love those autumn and wintry salads because you've got great leaves. So I probably do spinach and watercress, maybe some kind of red leaf as well. With I make a lovely dressing with pine nuts, garlic. I make it like pesto, but it doesn't have any cheese in it. So I'll just put lemon juice and olive oil into that and mix it in the blender, sort of adding the olive oil as we go.
Right.
And have a, I mean, that, there's so many flavors in that. So that is that's an easy meal for someone to do.
Diana, you could be an evangelist for the vegetable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Diana Henry's book is Salt, Sugar, Smoke. You're going to find her recipe for Turkish carrots and lentils on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take advantage of the possibilities. You can download our podcasts, get registered for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, take a look at our online stores, and get registered for our Book of the Month giveaway. It's all at splendidtable.org. So if a musician composes music for ice cream trucks, isn't it kind of logical that his next project would be to get together a bunch of famous chefs and put their recipes to music? It makes sense to me. Michael Hurst is a musician, and his band is One Ring Zero, and the chefs are the likes of David Chang, Mario Batali, and Michael Simon. And what came out of these machinations is a book and a CD called The Recipe Project. And Michael is here to explain all. Michael, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, how did you come up with this idea?
Well, I should, first of all, give credit also to Joshua Camp, who is my bandmate and co-composer. We've often collaborated and done interesting projects working with authors and songs about planets and working with dancers. And so for this one, it just, you know, it seemed appropriate to work with chefs.
Of course, very logical.
I should also point out that my brother-in-law is a chef, and so it all just sort of fell into place.
Well, so did you start with him?
We did. Chris Cosentino, who is my brother-in-law, lives in San Francisco, and he, soon after the author CD we did with the lyrics by various famous writers, suggested we do something similar with chefs. And I love the idea. I've always been interested in taking words, any set of words, even ones that aren't remotely poetic in the slightest, and trying to set them to music. So I talked to Joshua about it and said, what do you think about trying to take recipes and do this? And it was fortuitous that Chris was sort of starting to become famous in his own right with Iron Chef and various Food Network shows. And so, yeah, he was essentially the first person. And simultaneously to that, I got to know Mario Batali's assistant, Pam, who was coming into a coffee shop near my house where I spend way too much time. And I asked Pam, I said, what would it take to get a recipe from Mario Batali? And she pointed at some cookies on a shelf and said a few of those. So that's how I got Batali involved.
So can we hear one?
Sure. Chris Cosentino's. Just to make things even more complicated, I thought I would ask the chefs what style of music they liked and try to actually write the songs in that style. And Chris loves hip-hop, Beastie Boys, white boy hip-hop in particular. So this is our attempt to sing his recipe for Brains and Eggs. We made a great video with it, too. It's really fun.
So you have a video with each one of these songs.
Well, you know, one thing, not with all of them. Hopefully that will happen eventually. But I've always imagined this working so well on a cooking show, kind of like Schoolhouse Rock for food. And so if there's any video producers out there. But yeah, the videos are coming. But the Recipe Project website is going to include all these things. It keeps building with contests and videos and other recipes.
Play us another one.
Well, okay, so Issa Chandra Moskowitz, this is the complete opposite of Chris Cosentino. Issa is a vegan chef, and there are no brains in this recipe. She said she loved 90s girl rock in particular, you know, like the Throwing Muses and Belly and the Breeders. And, mm-hmm. and so I reached out to Tanya Donnelly, who amazingly said she would be willing to sing this. Tanya was in all three of those bands I just mentioned. And next thing I knew, I was recording Tanya singing words like peanut butter, and and I tried to make it sound somewhat 90s girl rock in that vein.
These are great. I mean, each one is completely different. So what was the toughest part of doing this?
All of it. you know, it was difficult to get a hold of the chefs, first of all. Chefs are extremely busy, I've come to realize. So that was one challenge. The next challenge was, of course, setting the songs to music, you know, and then especially with the musical stylings that some of the chefs suggested. So how about the most difficult song we had to compose for?
Yeah.
Aaron Sanchez gave us basically two pages of a recipe for duck breast with dulce de leche ancho chili glaze, and asked for a banda song.
Squeeze those juice.
Michael, that took real financing. Thanks for being with us and good luck.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Hurst is co-creator of The Recipe Project, a delectable extravaganza of food and music. Well, when Michael begins planning the sequel, here's a recipe for him. It's from our new book, How to Eat Weekends. It's pintos and red wine soup with 20 cloves of garlic. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Sleeves-up cuisine is what Jane Stern calls the kind of food she and Michael Stern check out for their road food site. Well, fact is, this is pretty much what we're all looking for right now. So, Jane, Michael, good to have you back with us.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, Lynn.
So, where have you two been? What's the latest discovery?
We have been in one of our favorite culinary treasure trove cities, Buffalo, New York. You know, Buffalo is famous for its wings. It also has great candy shops and ice cream parlors. One of the things Buffalo also has is fabulous sandwiches. In particular, one known as Beef on Weck, which is roast beef, hand-sliced nice and thin, piled high on a roll that is called a Weck roll, Weck being short for Kimmelwick, meaning caraway seed. The roll is kind of like a Kaiser roll or a hard roll, but the whole top is spangled with caraway seeds and pretzel salt, that kind of thick grain, coarse salt in abundance so that it really crunches when you bite into the roll. They say, the legend is that it was originally invented for bar patrons in order to induce thirst so they would buy more beer.
I believe it.
Okay, so now where do you get the very best Beef and Weck?
Well, traditionally, Michael and I have gone to the great bastions of Beef on Weck, which is Charlie the Butcher, Schwabel's, and Eccles. But this last time we were there, a couple of weeks ago, we went to a place called Steve's Pig and Ox Roast. I mean, the sign alone, of course, would stop you in your tracks. We didn't see any, you know, oxes on spits, but we did have wonderful buffalo-style roast beef, great lamb, and freshly roasted turkey over wood.
As well as pork, either sliced or pulled, on either a Kimmelwick roll or a regular roll. And what's great about Steve's Pig and Ox Roast is that it's the most informal of places. I mean, you step up to the counter, place your order. When it's ready, they call you. You carry it to a table on a tray. And the sandwiches for pork, lamb, turkey, or beef on Kimmelwick are maybe $5, $6 a piece. And it's one big, hearty sandwich. And I must say that the French fries that come on the side are some of the best. They're curly. They're thin,
curly fries,
thin
right.
And curly, kind of endlessly curly. So each piece is maybe a quarter of a potato.
That's right. I remember I picked one up and I stretched it out.
Yes.
It was like a yard long.
Right.
Only juice. And of course, you have to drink Loganberry juice, which is the Buffalo soft drink. It's what we used to call bug juice at sleepaway camp.
No, but there really are Loganberries. I think that at one point in time in the history of this beverage, there was a Loganberry somewhere near the water.
Probably a Loganberry at one point had been near, but I don't think you should really go expecting fresh squeezed Loganberries.
Guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. It's time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Let's see. Who are we going to talk to first? We have Emily calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Emily, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. Well, it's pumpkin puree season once again, and for convenience sake, I use it from the can. Unfortunately, so many recipes only call for using part of the can.
Right.
So I'm wondering, absent doing a double batch of something, have you got some ideas for things I can do with the other half of that can?
Yeah, which is usually not a huge amount, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing about pumpkin, because it's not really super duper flavorful, the canned stuff, it's what you do to it that makes it really good. You know, if you taste it just out of the can, it's not really quite wonderful. But one of the things I use it for is when I'm making a stew, I use it for thickening.
Ah.
You know, I mean, it's not that it's all that starchy, but it just adds a little bit of body. And when this, you know, I often will make these vegetable kind of soups slash stews with everything in it, but the kitchen sink, it's kind of cleaning out the fridge at the end of the week. And we, you know, we eat it over the weekend and it's easy. Throw in that little bit of pumpkin. Nobody will know, and you're not going to waste it.
Thank you. That's a great idea.
You are welcome. Another problem solved. 800-537-5252, or go to Facebook. Say hello to us. Follow us on Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Well, the weekly trivia challenge is ready, and the question is, what was used as money in Mexico before the Spaniards arrived? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I will talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're going to be talking with you in a moment, so you can get in touch, friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email, go to splendidtable.org, or phone us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what was used as money in Mexico before the Spaniards arrived? Well, one currency was cacao beans, and they had specific values. I mean, we think we invented bean-specific and plantation-specific chocolates. Well, the Aztecs were there long before we even dreamed of it. Cacao bean values were based on the types of trees that the beans came from or the regions that they came from. And there was another angle here. When Montezuma drank his hot chocolate, he was drinking money. I mean, it was sort of like lighting a cigar with a $100 bill. And when the Spaniards did come, they reported seeing all sorts and grades of cacao beans being sold in Aztec markets. And they said that people picked very carefully. The Spaniards had the impression that the best beans went to the emperor and to the dead, and that cacao beans and gold and jewels were all of equal value, which makes ultimate sense to me. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. The number is 800-537-5252. And you can friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email, splendidtable.org. We have Nancy calling from Carrollton, Ohio. Nancy, what is on your mind?
Well, hello, Lynn. Yes, we've had a wonderful crop of butternut squash this year, and usually what I do is just peel it and cut it up and save it for later in the winter. But I was wondering what if you might suggest some other ways I might fix it.
Oh, boy. Well, I use it every way you might use pumpkin. For instance, that's what I use for pumpkin pie.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's sweeter than a lot of pumpkins.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I use instead of sweet potatoes. Often, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of yams. And I love to use it in curries. And one of the things I'm going to be making this weekend, I love to do sort of a stew this time of year where I brown up some onion, dice up butternut squash, cabbage. The idea is I'm balancing the sweet vegetables of autumn against the more robust ones. So there'll be cut up cabbage that I'll brown. There'll be onions, carrots, and the squash, because those tend to be on the sweet side, right? And then there'll be Brussels sprouts, and there will be broccoli, and there will be rutabaga.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then there'll be a nice big ham hock.
you know, something really smoky.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'll brown that up, and it'll go some cloves of garlic and sweet paprika and caraway seed.
Oh, caraway. Good.
Yeah, yeah. And because I want smoky, I want it kind of Eastern European.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I want smoky. I want a little bit of that caraway. Don't overdo the caraway because it could kill you. You know,
right.
Just too much. I even, believe it or not that I think this is very Eastern European, but I throw in some tamarind concentrate because it has that fruity sourness.
Oh, yeah.
And then what I do is I add some red wine and some broth and or water, and I just let that all simmer.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have some thyme in there, you know, whatever herbs you might like. And you let that simmer. You don't want things falling apart, but you do want them tender.
Right.
And you then take all the meat off of the ham hock and let that sit in there. And beans could go in there as well. And you've got this great vegetable stew.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Oh, it's great. And then you could serve that over noodles.
Mm, sure.
But, you know, the real old-fashioned way of serving it is you get a really coarse multigrain bread.
Oh, yeah.
And you rub it with garlic and, you know, a little olive oil, and you put it in the oven, you toast it, and you put that in the bowl, and then you ladle the soup over it, and you've got dinner.
Oh, that sounds so great.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Wonderful ideas.
Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Bye.
Jim's on the line from St. Louis. Jim, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. So basically, I really want to turn on the husband charm. And
is there a problem here that you're trying to solve?
No. It's the only problem is I haven't done it in a while. So I wanted to do it not just for my wife's birthday or an anniversary. Basically, I want it to be the best meal that my wife has ever had.
Oh, that's very sweet, and there's no pressure here at all.
No, not at all. I mean, I'm not that technically skilled in the ways of fine cuisine, so I'm not really sure where to start.
Well, let's start with, what does she really love?
She really likes seafood. She loves scallops. But she's also a steak girl. I mean, she really likes steak.
Okay. What flavors does she like? Does she lean toward Asian taste? Does she lean toward Italian or French?
Well, a lot of her family is Italian, so I'm going to lean towards Italian.
Okay. You're going to do sautéed scallops for her with a lovely, lovely, very delicate tomato sauce. All right?
All right.
And the first thing you're going to do is you're going to make the tomato sauce. So in a skillet, you're going to film it with a bit of olive oil. All right?
Okay.
And you're going to get some shallots, like maybe three of them, and you're going to thin slice them. And you're going to sauté them over pretty high heat, fast sauté.
Okay.
And then you're going to drop in a clove of minced garlic and some fresh basil and give that a quick stir.
Okay.
And then you're going to add some white wine. And you're going to boil that white wine down to absolutely nothing. Now, that's with the fresh basil and the garlic. So that's your base right there.
Okay.
Now you're going to add four tomatoes that you've drained from a can of tomatoes. I like Muir Glen. Whole tomatoes, crush them with your hands, in they go, you saute them just a bit, and now, not too long at all, you just want to get rid of the excess moisture so it still tastes very bright and very fresh, and now you scrape that out of the pan, and you scrape just a little bit of orange rind over that. You grate a little bit of fresh orange rind over that.
That sounds good.
All right. Now, the next thing you're going to do is wash out that pan, film it with a little bit of olive oil. Take your scallops, which are nice, big, plump sea scallops, okay? You're going to rinse them, dry them completely. They have a little square little thing on the side. It looks like a little hinge. You're going to take that off because it's tough. You're going to sprinkle them with salt and pepper and just grate the smallest amount of orange rind over them. And sprinkle them with the tiniest, tiniest, tiniest few flakes of hot red pepper, okay? And now you're going to get that oil pretty hot and you're going to put the scallops in. You're going to figure three each, all right? And you're not going to let them touch. And you're going to sear them on one side so they get quite brown. And then you're going to very gently loosen them with a spatula, and you're going to turn them over and sear them on the other side. You do not want to cook them all the way through. So you're working over medium-high heat, okay? And when you press them and they still have give, you're going to take them off the heat. You're going to take them out of the pan, and you're going to arrange them on the plate.
So the idea is they're going to finish cooking on the plate. But before you put them on the plate, you're going to have made a puddle of that sauce on the plate. You're going to put these on the plate, and you're going to dribble a little bit more of the sauce, just a dot, on top of the scallops. And that's going to be her main course.
That sounds excellent.
Now, before that, you're going to have a very delicate light salad, and the salad should be something tart, like curly endive or a little bit of arugula with something like bib lettuce. So you want something delicate and tart, and you would toss that just with very good oil and very good vinegar. And you want to drink something lovely like a Pinot Gris from Washington State or from Oregon with those scallops.
Excellent.
I think you're going to have a nice, nice time, and I think she'll
like
it
definitely.
A lot. You're going to get a lot of husband points.
Excellent. Excellent.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Audrey is calling from Tacoma, Washington.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good.
My question is about curing olives.
Ah, okay.
We started growing a small olive tree, and this year it gave us a little crop. But I have been researching this and have come up with all kinds of insane things to do and not sure what to do.
What have you found?
I found all online and books things such as putting big vats of lye in your closet, and that just didn't sound right to me.
Well, there's a lot of ways to cure an olive. The idea is that there's a particular acid in a raw olive that you want to neutralize.
Uh-huh.
Because you can't eat a raw olive.
Right.
I would say there's a couple of dependable authors. And there's a book called The Feast of the Olive.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember who wrote it. I think the first name of the author was Mort. He will be a dependable source.
Great.
Anything by Nancy Harmon Jenkins will be spot on.
Great.
Anything by Paula Wolfert will be spot on. So these are three people you want to look up.
Super. That's okay. Exactly what I'm looking
yeah.
for.
Yeah. And I come from a family that does it.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah. My family in Tuscany makes their own olive oil and they cure their own olives. And there's several different methods that you can use. One of them is a brine,
mm-hmm.
essentially using salt.
Mm-hmm.
And the olives go into that brine for a long period of time. And then another one is using lye. Now, the lye cure is usually considered to be sort of the short, lazy man's cure.
I see.
And a lot of people believe it doesn't allow the true taste of the olive to come through.
Okay.
But I can't remember the details. It's been a long time since I was, you know, standing there at the vat watching them go in and, you know, making all those notes. Oh, the other thing is there was a book on olive oils, which may talk about it, by Deborah Krasner. And if she discusses it, she did a fine book on olive oils. And Deborah Krasner, if she talks about the curing of olives, you can trust her.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of stuff out there that's a lot of misinformation and hearsay.
That's what it seemed like to me.
Yeah. But one thing you have to know, when you pick them, you do it right away. They cannot sit and wait. That's when stuff gets into trouble.
And you wait until they're fully ripe before you pick them?
A lot of people pick them when they are literally green.
Ah.
Yeah, you don't have to wait until they're fully ripe.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay?
Hey, thanks so much, Lynn.
You are welcome.
All right, have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Jessica got to us on Facebook, and she explained that she's 25 years old, and she's getting ready to move out on her own again, but she's on a really tight budget. So she wants to know, what are some of the staples she could have in her pantry and some cheap recipes that are healthy? Okay, here's the deal. Dried beans, which are very inexpensive. I mean, if you take 1 pound of, for argument's sake, dried pintos, and you cook those up, I mean, you're going to have them for a week, all right? And by the way, they freeze. So you want beans, you want grains, and then you want lots of fresh greens and fresh vegetables. So here's an idea. If you take some cooked beans, all right, and I always cook the beans with a lot of garlic and some sautéed onion, because right on their own, they're going to be delicious. All I do is I warm them up and I put a squeeze of lemon on them and toss them with some olive oil. But let's take some cooked beans and then let's take something really fast, like whole wheat couscous. Whole wheat couscous, you don't have to cook. All you have to do is moisten it until it's tender. You just add a little water and you sift it between your hands until it's tender enough to eat. You toss that together with some fresh cucumber, okay, some carrot, some celery,
a bit of onion, some fresh lemon juice, and whatever seasonings you like. Now, I love fresh mint, but I wait until it's really cheap in the farmer's market. And that gives you a salad that you could have for lunch, you could have for dinner. You could pile that on romaine leaves or any other lettuce leaf and roll it up, and it's like your own spring roll. And then what you should do is go to the Splendid Table website, splendidtable.org, because we've got a whole collection of cheap eats. So tons of recipes there that are really inexpensive and really healthy. Hey, thanks for the question. Reach us, 800-537-5252. Eileen's on the phone from Proctorville, Ohio. What's on your mind?
Hi. I got a call from my son about trying to locate something for his chocolate gala that he is preparing for his lab group.
Wow.
And he wants to have chocolate incorporated in every course.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the dessert is easy. The main course, however, is proving to be a bit of a challenge for him, and I said Lynn would have the answer. So,
now, wait a minute. What is he doing this for?
He just loves to cook. He's in graduate school, and he loves to cook, and his lab group gets together periodically just to have fun, and he thought it would be great to have an evening of just preparing a chocolate evening.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, what comes to mind? Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the great mole sauce of Mexico that's done with turkey, okay? But that's an investment of a good, solid day of work. It's fabulous. But you know what occurs to me? You get your hands on decent cocoa. You mix that with something like ancho chili, which is a ground ancho chili. It's now in a lot of supermarkets. It's a very velvety, not terribly hot chili. You add some garlic to that. And you add some vinegar and brown sugar, and you rub that into, a pork shoulder or butt roast, or you rub it into a piece of beef and you slow roast it. And the great thing about this slow roasting of these cuts that have a lot of marbling in them is you can generally reheat them pretty easily. And that flavor, you can just rub it in, let it sit overnight, then do a slow roast. Fabulous.
Right.
So it's cocoa, ancho chili powder, which is this velvety, warm, slightly hot chili, brown sugar, a bit of vinegar, garlic.
And just rub it in the night before, let it sit.
Let it sit there. And by the way, it could be chicken thighs. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it could be anything. But I'm thinking relatively inexpensive for grad students, easy to cook, and really forgiving.
Great. And an appetizer?
An appetizer? Let's see. How about, I've got it. Let's go really Mexican. Get a can of chipotle chilies in adobo. These are these smoky, very hot chilies in this sort of tomato vinegar sauce. Take one of them, because they're potent, and puree that with a tomato sauce and more of that cocoa or bittersweet chocolate. And what you want to do is add to that some lemon juice or a bit of vinegar. And then that gets spread on something like crisp tortilla chips.
Wonderful.
It's going to just light them up big time.
They will love it. I knew you would have the answer.
Oh, I love it. Tell them to have a great time for me.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome, Eileen.
Bye-bye. Now.
Ooh, I love the idea of a multi-course chocolate party. Yeah. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Stay in touch. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous, who said, "Never trust a woman who would turn a perfectly respectable vegetable, like broccoli, into a casserole with cheese." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcast, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest series, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. You're going to find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.